Hey, it's Mel Robbins. Let's cut to the chase. There is a change you want to make right now, but you're waiting to feel motivated. You don't need motivation. You've got me. You can change your life anytime you want. And when you're ready, the Mel Robbins podcast is here to help you with inspiration and simple science-backed tools to help you create a better life. Listen to me and you'll feel motivated, all right. Listen and follow the Mel Robbins podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, everyone, and happy Lunar New Year to all throughout the Asian diaspora who are celebrating. Today marks the start of the Year of the Tiger, for those in the know, and the Lunar New Year is considered a time for renewal and rebirth. But we begin the readout tonight with the man who went into the cocoon as a cheesy television star and came out as an authoritarian Mothman, the wannabe dictator who nearly toppled our democracy in his final days in office. The New York Times is out with new reporting on the effects on the efforts by Donald Trump and his advisors to use the authority of the federal government to seize voting machines after the 2020 election. And it reveals that Trump was far more involved than previously known. The Times reports that 6 weeks after Election Day, with his hold on power slipping, Donald Trump directed his lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, to ask the Department of Homeland Security if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states. That's according to three people familiar with the matter who say that Giuliani called the department's acting deputy secretary, who told him he lacked the authority to audit or impound the machines. It's a reminder that Trump's attempted coup only failed because of a handful of government officials who were willing to put their foot down. And this was not some fledgling idea. It was actually put in writing. The plan to seize the machines was the subject of several draft executive orders, one of which Politico obtained last month. And while those orders were never enacted, they cast a dark shadow over the democratic process. According to the Times, the idea originated with Phil Waldron, the retired Army colonel and Trump advisor, who's also famous for his conspiracy-driven PowerPoint presentation, which recommended that Trump declare a national security emergency. Worse yet, Waldron was collaborating on the plan to seize voting machines with Trump's 22-day national security advisor, admitted felon, QAnon devotee, and disgraced retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. And Trump not only embraced the idea, he pitched it far and wide. According to the Times, he proposed using local law enforcement to seize voting machines in Michigan and Pennsylvania, but state lawmakers refused. He pitched the Justice Department, but even Trump's hired goon, Attorney General William Barr, refused. He considered using the military, but members of his team advised against it. And finally, Trump pitched the Department of Homeland Security, but they also said no. It's another indication of how close we came to a constitutional crisis. And yet, Republicans have been notably silent about the news. Joining me now is Jill Weinbanks, MSNBC legal analyst, former Watergate prosecutor and co-host of the Sisters-in-Law podcast, which is now 1 year old. Happy anniversary. And Michael Steele, MSNBC political analyst and former chair of the RNC. And Jill, I want to start with you. You know, reading through this Time story, one of the things that stood out to me was that the plan to get the military to seize voting machines was even too bananas for Rudy Giuliani. Even he said, no, you can't use the military that way. So if it was too much for Rudy Giuliani, it was clearly too much. As somebody who was involved in the investigation of Richard Nixon, give me your perspective on this alleged plan to try to seize American voting machines.
To me, and also remember, I worked in the Pentagon, so I'm familiar with the limitations and using the military for any civilian purposes. This was really wrong. It was wrong on every level, and it's all part of what I would call an overarching conspiracy. This is a plot to interfere with Congress doing the electoral vote confirmation, but it's a widespread conspiracy to overturn the election and to overturn the votes of millions of voters. That's what's so terrible about this. And it goes to not just the Pentagon. He tried to get the Department of Justice. He tried to get Department of Homeland Security. He tried to get states. He made phone calls to Georgia. He had other people calling and visiting Georgia. He had fake electoral slates of electors. That is outrageous. And all of that put together shows the intent of the, I hope you can't hear my background noise. It's my doorbell.
We love dogs on the show, so they're always welcome to be on as well.
Anyway, it is a very big conspiracy. And all this complaint about, is there proof of President Trump's intent?
Yeah.
Put all this together, and I'm sorry, but there is more than enough circumstantial evidence of his intent. We don't need him anymore. It is his intent to commit a crime.
You know, it is sort of stunning, even though I'm not surprised anymore, Michael Steele, that the Republican Party writ large has been quite quiet, very silent. They're sort of banging, you know, their hands on the table, claiming that Democrats want to take federal control over state elections. And yet here you have the president of the United States wanting to take the ultimate federal control, literally take voting machines out of his desperation to not be seen to have lost an election and to try to cling to power like a sort of tin pot dictator. What do you think it would take to get every Republican other than Liz Cheney and Kinzinger to actually have some outrage about this?
Oh, I think we need to stop wasting time on that front. I really think that, you know, in the media, certainly in the political space, sitting around waiting for the Republican Party to be enlightened and understand exactly what Jill just laid out, from both a political as well as a legal and governmental perspective, is like waiting for Godot. You're just sitting at the bus stop waiting. And then the bus never shows up, right? So the reality of it is, now the question falls back on the American people, mm-hmm. falls back on you, me, and others mm-hmm. to decide, what are we going to do about this? How we're going to hold this former leadership accountable for the actions that they are, that's now being revealed to us, that they engaged in to overthrow our government, to take control of our electoral process to the extent that they could, to cheat. They are cheaters. They're liars. And the more we're honest about that, and less we're concerned we are about how Republicans feel about it, the better off this country is going to be, and the stronger attitudes we're going to have about dealing with this. Because let me tell you, folks, this is all a warm-up. Mm-hmm. You now see what's coming. They're telegraphing to you what's coming next. You give us the power back, we're putting you in jail. You give us the power back, we're going to take control of the of those systems of government that we failed to take control of the last time and get it right for us the next time.
Yeah, I mean, just going through here, the Hill, silent. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, silent. House Minority Whip Steve Scalise, silent. Elise Stefanik of New York, the head of the House Republican Conference, asked for comment. They're just not going to talk about it because they clearly, Jill Winebanks, want to take advantage of what Donald Trump created for themselves, should they be able to seize power. They wouldn't have to ever give it back. Just to go through, you lived through the Nixon era in which his mental health was questioned at a certain point, whether he was drinking, what he was doing, sort of as he was spiraling toward the end. There is, some of these stories are wild. The Washington Post reporting that when some of the records, some of the White House records were turned over to the National Archives, some of them were ripped in little pieces. Like ripped in little shreds. And we've seen, I think, in some of the previous biographies of Trump that he would have this habit. He didn't like some who just ripped the pieces up and still turn them in ripped pieces. In some cases, they had to take the torn up records and put them back together and paste them back together. You had Donald Trump giving $1 million to his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, nonprofit. And this was after the creation of the January 6th panel. And you have to remember that Meadows wrote a book, right? The tax-deductible seven-figure contribution to the Conservative Partnership Institute led by him, the largest chunk of the $1.3.5 million in donations that Trump, his PAC, gave out, was to Meadows, who then later repudiated his own book, which sounds a lot like trying to influence him. Your thoughts, Jill?
Well, I think you've laid out a very good case for obstruction of a witness and tampering with a witness, which is what that does sound like. All of these conducts fall together. I think it's time for the announcement of a special grand jury. It would assure the American people that the Department of Justice is actually doing something without violating the grand jury secrecy. All you have to do is appoint, as there was in Watergate, going back to that era, there was a special grand jury appointed to address only the investigation of the crimes of Watergate. And the fact that that existed assured people that we were taking seriously crimes committed by the, well, at that time, still the sitting president and all of his colleagues. And I think people are really fed up now and getting really worried. The threats that were issued by Donald Trump at his last rally and the promise of pardons is terrifying to me, because what does it matter, even if justice were to go ahead and find crimes and indict people, if Donald Trump wins, he's already said, I'll undo all of that. I will pardon the January 6th violent insurrectionists. And clearly he would issue pardons to anybody else indicted. So we have to make sure that he doesn't get into a position. You said it. This is a forewarning. Or maybe it was Michael who said, This is just telling us, if you don't stop us now, we're going to just learn from our past mistakes. Okay, we didn't succeed. And to the extent that any Republicans have had the courage to say anything, they've said, well, it's a good thing that we had people in place who didn't follow his instructions. No, that's not good enough for a democracy. We need to not be able to rely on someone standing up to the president and saying no. That's a good thing. I'm not disputing that, but it's not enough. We need a president who's not going to make those pressure points to make our elections unfair.
Well, and because we won't have anybody standing up to him the next time, right? I think all of the incentives here, Michael, are to wait for Trump to theoretically come back and wipe it all away, wipe the January 6th committee away, wipe all the crimes away. We have the head of the Oath Keepers. He's going to appear for the January 6th committee. He's going to take the fifth. There is no incentive at this point to cooperate with investigating this crime against the country, because essentially he's telegraphing Trump that I can wipe it all away, just put me back in power, which is an incentive for people even like Mitch McConnell, et cetera, to cooperate with him, not with justice.
Oh, yeah. This whole process has been about how MAGA world is incentivized to turn out, how they're incentivized to keep their mouth shut, how they're incentivized not to cooperate. And the manipulation that you see certainly at the rally in Texas this past weekend is this idea that what I'm going to do for you, you give me the power, this is what I'm going to do for you. The other side of that, though, and I think we need to be keen about this, it's not so much Trump becoming the next president of the United States in 2024. It's if he decides not to, who's going to be MAGA-like him? Who's going to be the closest to him, whether it's DeSantis or someone else? So this is the narrative that you've got to understand, because the pressure now is not coming so much from Trump. It's going to come from that MAGA base that has an expectation of how they will corrupt the system, or how they think they're fixing the system to make it better for themselves and their MAGA world. So I think we need to think broadly about what we see here as well as specifically with respect to Trump.
Indeed. Oh, no. And how they can rule this country regardless of what the majority wants, essentially permanently, if they get back into power. That's what we need to really think about. Our democracy is definitely in peril. Jill Weinbanks, Michael Steele, thank you both very much. And up next on The Readout, the game changer. COVID vaccines could be available for young children by the end of the month. Dr. Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General of the United States, joins me next. Plus, a Readout exclusive, Baltimore prosecutor Marilyn Mosby joins me in her first interview since federal charges were announced against her. Plus, it is Black History Month. Can we still call it that without hurting anybody's feelings? This year, it arrives with an all-out effort to erase Black history in our schools. And tonight's absolute worst are also attacking Black America, but in an even more disingenuous and hypocritical way. The Readout continues after this.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
So we have huge game-changing news on the COVID front tonight. Just hours ago, Pfizer-BioNTech ask the Food and Drug Administration to expand the use of its COVID-19 vaccine to children ages 6 months to 5 years. The application included data on the safety and effectiveness of two doses of the vaccine, though the company says that it plans on submitting data for a third dose in the coming months. Those first two shots could be cleared for the age group by the end of this month. You can practically hear the sighs of relief by the parents who have felt left behind in the vaccine race, those tethered to a COVID limbo that has only worsened under Omicron as shuttered daycares, childcare disruptions, and hospitalizations have driven them to the breaking point. According to a Monmouth poll, 70% of Americans say it is time to just accept COVID and move on. For those who couldn't move on, relief may be coming. Still, questions remain. Joining me now is U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy. And this is great. This is actually good news, General Murthy. Talk to us about the safety of these vaccines for children 6 months and up, because a lot of parents have been stuck because their child is too young to get vaccinated. They're vaccinated, but they're kind of stuck. What can you tell parents who are still a little nervous, though? They're fine with giving them, you know, getting the vaccine for themselves, but they're still a little nervous about giving it to a baby or a toddler.
Well, Joy, I would certainly understand parents who have questions about the possibility of a vaccine for kids under five or for any kids of any age, because as parents, our job first and foremost is to protect the well-being of our kids. And so I just first want to say to all parents out there, if you got questions, that's okay. You know, our job is to help you get those questions answered. I'm also one of those parents with a child under five. I have a daughter who just turned four. My wife and I have been eagerly waiting the day where we can vaccinate her. She always asks us when can she get vaccinated like her five-year-old brother. And our hope is that today's news about Pfizer submitting that data might bring us one step closer to that day. But here's what's going to happen now. The FDA, as it gathers this information from Pfizer, is going to do a careful and thorough analysis of that data with an intent to answer two critical questions. Is this vaccine safe for kids under five? And is it effective? They will have an advisory group that meets publicly to talk about that. The data that they're considering will also be made publicly available because this will be a transparent process. And only then will they actually opine on it, after which the CDC will also weigh in. That's several steps in that process. But the reason all those steps exist is to make sure that whatever decision is rendered is one that parents can feel absolutely confident about.
To make parents feel confident, it needs to probably not just be an emergency authorization. Is this going to be a full-on authorization, not emergency?
Well, Joy, the FDA will consider that, you know, although I think it's likely, you know, they're going to also look at the emergency use authorization. That's the approach that's been taken for other vaccines, including vaccines for kids of older age groups, 5 to 11, and also the adolescent age group. But the good news is that what we have seen, actually, in those older age groups, as well as in adults, by the way, for whom an emergency use authorization was first granted, is that the safety profile has remained quite strong. And the effectiveness has been great. Joy, just in the last few weeks, for example, we have seen data from the CDC about our experience with Omicron that has showed that if you are vaccinated and boosted, your chances of not only making it through, but, you know, avoiding hospitalizations and death are dramatically higher compared to those who are unvaccinated. And I anticipate that, again, if the FDA considers this and authorizes this vaccine, mm-hmm. it will be because it is both safe and effective.
Let me go through some of these numbers here. You know, I mentioned earlier 70% of Americans saying they just want to move on from COVID. Republicans, it's almost 90%. It's almost 9 in 10. 71% of independents, 47% only of Democrats. Fully vaccinated in this country, and that's for age 5 to 11, it's only 28.1%. Only 18.8% of children have gotten one dose per the Kaiser Family Foundation, even though 74.2% of all U.S. adults are fully vaccinated. And the places where it's the lowest are places in the South and also in Republican states. Are we going to get to the point where we're going to have to add COVID vaccines to the mandated vaccines that kids, the MMR and the other vaccines that kids have to get to go to school? I think one place in New Orleans, actually, the city of New Orleans is going to be the first major district that's actually going to do that. They're going to mandate it for kids 5 and up. Is that where we're going to have to go? Adding this to the other vaccines kids have to get to go to school?
Well, Joy, I think a couple of things to note is that vaccines for adults have been around the longest. And we saw that when those vaccines first came out, that the percentage of adults who said they wanted to get vaccinated was actually low. But then it grew over time as people talked to their doctors, as they saw other people get vaccinated and as they realized these vaccines are safe and they also work well. When it comes to kids, you know, we're on that path as well. We are seeing confidence grow, but gosh, we really would like the numbers to increase more quickly because the more kids who are vaccinated, the safer they'll be. I know that there are parts of the country where localities are considering vaccine requirements for children. Those are local decisions, and I anticipate those discussions will continue. But I'll tell you from my standpoint as Surgeon General, my focus has been on making sure that parents out there and kids have the information they need, accurate information. And one of the big barriers for us, Joy, has been that there is a lot of misinformation that is floating out there about the vaccines that's being, in some cases, actively propagated. And that is harmful to our children. It's harmful to all of us.
Well, I mean, people are profiting off of the misinformation. So, I mean, for people who are, you know, listening to certain podcasts and taking their medical information from them rather than from you, the Surgeon General, what is your sort of elevator pitch to them? If you're still not vaccinated right now and you're like, I've made it this far, I don't need it, what would be your elevator pitch to that person?
Well, I always start with listening to people's concerns. Everyone has a different approach. Some people are concerned about, you know, whether they work. Some people have questions about safety. Other people are wondering if they really need the vaccine. So I try to understand where people are and then meet them where they are. I also try to help people understand that we now have a tremendous amount of experience with these vaccines, more than 500 million doses administered in the United States. And we've learned two things during that time. Even in the face of Omicron, the vaccines work very well. They also are remarkably safe. But I think we got to talk to people at a human level about this, without judgment, without blame. It's something that I learned very early on as a doctor. That's our key to making sure that we reach people with accurate, life-saving information. And we just can't give up on folks.
You are the right man to do it. You're such a calming influence. We really appreciate you, U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy. Thank you very much. We appreciate you very much. All right. Still ahead. High-profile Baltimore prosecutor Marilyn Mosby will appear in court for the first time this week as a defendant. She's facing a series of federal charges, and she joins me tonight in her first interview since that indictment was announced. That is next on The Readout. First met Marilyn Mosby at an event for the amazing group Black Girls Vote in Baltimore in 2014 with the late great Representative Elijah Cummings. And then again when I covered the Baltimore uprising in the wake of the police killing of Freddie Gray a year later. Now, I can recall thinking the state attorney's push to vigorously prosecute the officers who killed Freddie Gray was a bold move, particularly for a rather rare Black state attorney. Police are rarely held to account in the deaths of unarmed people, particularly Black people. And the police unions are powerful, and their political influence is real. Those officers were eventually cleared by a judge's ruling. Mosby has taken other political risks during her tenure, moving to decriminalize sex work and marijuana, which particularly matters in a city like Baltimore, where poverty is high and the police-community relationship is notoriously poor. So I will admit, I was surprised when Attorney Mosby came back into the news cycle at very much the other end of the spectrum. Accused by the Justice Department of financial crimes and facing up to 20 years in prison if convicted. Yes, I mean the same Justice Department that seems to be awfully slow when it comes to the former president, Donald Trump. So I asked if she would come on to the show to talk about it, and she and her attorney said yes. So joining me now is Marilyn Mosby, state's attorney for Baltimore City, and her attorney, A. Scott Bolden. Thank you both for being here.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate it.
Thank
and I know this
us.
Is, a, of course, this is a high-pressure situation. There is an arraignment this Friday.
Yeah, there's an arraignment this Friday, Joy.
And I mean, for you, who is somebody who has, you know, devoted your life to, you know, putting the bad guys in jail and fighting for criminal for justice, how does that feel to be in this position?
It doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest with you, you know, as I expected as a state's attorney that, you know, fighting for racial justice in the criminal justice system, fighting to end mass incarceration in a state where you have the largest sort of incarceration of Black people in the entire nation, I understood that I was going to get pushback. But never did I or could I have ever imagined that I would be mocked, that I would be ridiculed, that I would receive hate mail, that I would receive death threats. They would describe how my husband would be killed coming out of my house and how no police officers would respond, how they would target my children, right? And I never expected the lawsuits, and I never expected to be on this side of the fence where when the only thing that I'm attempting to do is to provide equal justice to all, regardless of race, sex, religion, and occupation.
So let's do the elephant in the room. Let's talk about the charges. What you're accused of, you know, when you buy a home, you can take money out of your 401k. Yep. There are strict rules as to when you can do it, to take money out early. You are accused of taking money out of your 401k early to buy homes and not being honest about why, using the CARES Act, you know, which benefits people who are financially having financial issues, and then using sort of incorrect information about liens, not disclosing them, and using that to get loans. That's sort of just the summary of what you're accused of.
So let me,
how do you respond
to that?
Let me
just be clear, and I'll defer to my attorney on the specifics, but this has been a long-term investigation that has gone through every aspect of my life. From my charitable donations to my tax returns, they have interviewed every political donator. They have gone to my hairdresser, my children's dance instructors. And this is ultimately, they sent subpoenas to black churches throughout the city of Baltimore. In an election year, I'm 4 months from my election, right? And this is what they come back with. Me accessing my own personal funds that I put away every single week. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I'll defer to my attorney, there's ulterior motives for something like this, for an attack like this.
But when you bring an indictment, if I may, when you bring an indictment 4 months before an election, when you don't sit down with the defense and tell them what you're looking for and what you're looking at before you bring the indictment, you're not trying to find justice or truth. You're trying to affect the outcome of her reelection effort. When you have a prosecutor like Leo Wise, who targets historically African-American elected officials, who gave two contributions, probably the only contributions he's ever given, to her opponents in her last election, and he leads this prosecution. It should have been a criminal, it started off as a criminal tax investigation, and now you have these charges that are not only false, but we've got exculpatory evidence to prove them wrong.
So talk a little bit about that, because there are two prosecutors on. There's Leo Wise, who, to your point, is true. He has donated to your opponent in the past. There's a second prosecutor on who's a Democratic appointee who's not sort of in the Leo Wise sort of world. And what they're essentially saying is that, you know, these were kind of ill-gotten gains. Like, they were used, that even though they were your money, that you're using your 401k money, that you violated the rules for how you could access it and didn't tell about sort of things like tax liens and things you should have done.
But there's no objective standard for that. This is a subjective standard. Remember, this isn't PPP money.
Okay.
This is money, her own money in her 457B. And if there's anyone in America that wasn't financially impacted one way or the other by COVID, this COVID relief plan allowed her to take this money. That's the law, if you will. In regard to the homes that she bought, the mortgage applications, we were not aware, she was not aware of the tax liens at issue. And given the IRS and the understaffing and overwork issues we've seen, we could have certainly shared that with the government, but this was a criminal tax investigation. And so, again, if you're not willing to talk with us, this is a sitting government official who every day wakes up to do law enforcement and enforce the law and protect the citizens of Baltimore. If you won't talk with her or her lawyers before you get an indictment, again, you're not really interested in justice.
So are you saying that, you know, you attempted to talk with this prosecutor? Did you attempt to contact the prosecutor to explain what happened, to explain, like, how this money was acquired, and you were rebuffed?
Absolutely. I can tell you that we have offered to, I have offered to go in front of the grand jury. Mm-hmm. For whatever they were coming at me with, and they have rejected that. But this is more so about the fact that he wasn't able to do what he did in his donations, which was to support my opponents. And he's using this indictment 4 months before my election to have this cloud of aspersion over my head. And so I get it. Like, I have done things as a prosecutor that a lot of other prosecutors have not done in this country, whether that is holding police accountable when a lot of other prosecutors in this country would not do so, whether that is ending the war on drugs, which we know was a war on black people in the city of Baltimore, whether that is exonerating 12 innocent black men who the criminal justice system was willing and able to allow to rot for 300 years in jail for crimes they did not commit. Right? I've done things that would upset the status quo, but to understand and to recognize all that they've attempted to do. I've been mocked. I've been ridiculed. I've gotten hate mail. I've gotten death threats. I've gotten it all. I've gotten lawsuits. OIG investigations, state ethics investigations, they've been coming for my law license since I charged those officers in Freddie Gray. They literally kept an open and pending investigation against me for 3 years. And so I get it. But at the end of the day, what I hope most people in the city of Baltimore understand and recognize is that this is more about my election than anything else.
And you, so, you know, and I guess that is the question, right? Because I think for a lot of people that are sort of looking at this case, they're sort of looking at the DOJ and saying, wait a minute, you know, you have Donald Trump with sort of decades and decades and decades of not paying taxes and seeming to defraud insurance companies, et cetera. And there's been sort of no action. Mm-hmm. This was this a publicly announced indictment? How public was it? Because I think that is the dichotomy, I think, that
the government released the indictment and to the press and to her lawyers. Mm-hmm. A week or so ago, and that's when we first got notice of it. As I said, normally you would have a meeting with the defense attorneys. But let's talk about where we are right now. We're 4 months out from her election. Mm-hmm. We are ready for trial. The government should be ready for trial. We're certainly going to try to get the indictment dismissed, if you will. Mm-hmm. But we finally have an independent arbiter, an independent judge, federal judge, to look at everything that we've talked about, everything the government has done. We went to the Office of Professional Responsibility at DOJ. They said no. We went to the Criminal Tax Division of DOJ. They said no. And so now we have a federal judge who's going to take a look at this.
The federal judge is going to look at the actual sort of allegations one by one. Is your allegation
and the conduct of the government prosecutors.
So you're doing both. I mean, is it an actual innocence claim saying you did not access this money, or is more the claim about the unfairness of the prosecution?
It's certainly both.
Is it both?
It's both.
It's sort of both.
And we lead with the motion to dismiss, mm-hmm. the indictment based on bad faith and bad conduct on the part of the conflicts on the part of the government prosecutor. And then secondly, we're ready for trial. We want to take this to trial within 60 days because Ms. Mosby is still running for re-election. And so let's find out. Let's find out what it's going to be.
Let me play a little bit of the announcement that you made. You came out pretty forthrightly and stood in front of your workplace and made an announcement. I'm going to play a little bit of it right now. Take a look.
I offered to prove my innocence by making myself available to present exculpatory evidence to the grand jury. But the U.S. attorney and the lead prosecutor in the case, who is donated to my political opponents and who has personal animus towards me, has refused to allow me to do so. Please don't be fooled. We are now 5 months from my next election, and this indictment is merely a political ploy by my political adversaries to unseat me.
How long do you intend to fight this out? Like, what you're 4 months from an election. You're going to have to go through the process. You are running for re-election.
Let me just say one thing. I have fought Donald Trump, who said I needed to be prosecuted. I have fought against William Barr, who called me a rogue prosecutor. I have fought against my Republican governor, who doesn't agree with my policies. I know I've been through it all. I am built for this, Joy. And so I understand the shoulders that I stand on, and I'm ready to fight. I know I've done nothing wrong. So I'm ready to go to trial tomorrow. Put this on trial right now so I can prove my innocence. But let's get to the election because I know that's what this is all about.
Thank you very much, Marilyn Mosby, Attorney Marilyn Mosby, A. Scott Bolden. Thank you both. Really appreciate you coming forward.
We will keep
an eye on what's going on as well on Friday. Thank you very much. Don't go anywhere. Tonight's Absolute Worst is next.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
It was only a matter of time before Senate Republicans began discrediting President Biden's eventual nominee to replace Justice Stephen Breyer as being unqualified since she will be a black woman. So take a deep breath, and away we go.
The irony is that the Supreme Court is at the very same time hearing cases about this sort of affirmative racial discrimination.
Yes.
And while adding someone who is the beneficiary of this sort of quote.
What President Biden did was, as a candidate, make this pledge. And that help politicize the entire nomination process.
I gotta say, that's offensive.
Right.
You know, black women are what, 6% of the U.S. population? He's saying to 94% of Americans, I don't give a damn about you. You are ineligible. It's actually an insult to black women.
You know, it's actually offensive and insulting that Raphael the Canadian took it upon himself to speak for black women. You don't. And it's equally offensive that they've all just doubled down. Roger Wicker said he would let his comments stand. Susan Collins has concerns, as usual. But she's unconcerned that Ronald Reagan literally did the same thing, made the exact same campaign promise to put a woman on the court. Perennial absolute worst candidate Cruz, who wouldn't even defend his own wife and father, kicked off Black History Month today by defending himself and claiming that Democrats are casually racist because of Biden's pledge. Apparently, Ted prefers his racism to be formal. And Cancun Cruz's complaints about the nominee's records and credentials are just crocodile tears. He wasn't bothered when Mango Mussolini was nominated judges to the federal bench who were deemed not qualified by the American Bar Association. And Ted knows that by the standards for that the standards for justice can be, you know, variable. And because he was on Orange Julius Caesar's shortlist back in 2020. I'm sorry, I can't stop laughing. Please stop laughing. Until Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed, at which time the orange man unequivocally promised it will be a woman. So here's a reminder for Ted Cruz and the rest. In the court's 233-year history, the only informal requirement was essentially that they be a white man. Since 1789, of the 115 Supreme Court justices, 108 have been white men. That is about 94%. Surely these Republicans know that there aren't any constitutional requirements for being a justice. The person doesn't even have to be a lawyer or even have a law degree. Or that more than 40% of justices nominated since 1900 didn't have any prior judicial experience before becoming justices. But now that a black woman is under consideration, oh, well, she has to be far superior for a white man to be told tough luck, as Cruz said. So Republicans' disingenuous and racist attacks to malign whoever President Biden's nominee might be, each of whom, by the way, is all but guaranteed to be far more intelligent than any of them, y'all are the absolute worst. But it's only natural for the party waging war against black history to continue to whitewash history. And now they're even taking on Michelle Obama's biography. That is next. Happy Black History Month, America. Enjoy it while it lasts, because given the political discourse lately, Republican-led states will probably ban the celebration next year, citing reverse racism and dangerous ideology. I'm mostly kidding. No, I'm not. But lately, we've seen a collective freakout by conservatives who are just triggered by the 1619 Project, which is a book that asks Americans to have a more honest understanding of slavery's role in our collective history. Right-wing political organizations have seized on the freakout and pushed a national book banning movement because those books are supposedly indoctrinating kids to a dangerous ideology. It just so happens that the majority of the books targeted are written by women, people of color, or LGBTQ authors who write about diversity of issues that don't solely focus on America's white, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon, secular saints. NBC News discovered that in Houston, Texas, one parent wanted to ban a children's biography of Michelle Obama because, wait for it, she says it promotes reverse racism. Another parent, who is a member of the F My Feelings crowd in Dallas, wanted to ban a kid's book about the life of a black Olympian. Now, I'm named Wilma Rudolph. You should know that name because, wait for it, it mentioned racism. Joining me now is Michael Eric Dyson, professor of African-American studies at Vanderbilt University and author of Entertaining Race, Performing Blackness in America, which will probably soon show up on banned books lists everywhere. Dr. Dyson, as an educator, as a college professor, just give me your sort of raw reaction to the fact that we are on the first day of Black History Month, and the thing to do du jour on the Republican side is to ban any book that's got anything, the word black in it, the word history in it, or the word racism in it.
Yeah, it's predictable, Joy. It's ironic, it's paradoxical, and both of those are real, but it's also tragic and contradictory. On the one hand, America is obsessed with history. Can't get enough of the founding fathers, the founding mothers, the founding brothers. There's something like 15,000 books, I think, on Abraham Lincoln alone. Yes. So this is a nation. And then recreations of the Confederacy. Oh, my God, every big battle. Yes, yes. But when it comes to black people, can you get over it? So you can do all these reenactments. You can do all this founding fathers, mothers and brothers and all that. But when it comes to us or any history that is inconvenient, that challenges a worldview that says the white people are at the center of the universe and everybody else are spokes and satellites, it's problematic. So Ted Cruz is kvetching about standards when it comes to black women, knowing, reading Ira Katz Nelson's book, When Affirmative Action Was White. Get it? Y'all started the thing. Y'all got the hookup. Nobody asked you questions of merit. You know your Uncle Bubba is dumb as two dumb hammers on the end of a lead pole. And yet at the same time, that person gets a job. God bless him. But so when standards are evoked and merit is evoked, you know these are racist attempts to undermine the credibility of black people and the legitimacy of our intelligence. And to do it during black history is so precious, but let's have the battle and let's keep going on to ban books.
I mean, I thought this was freedom. I mean, Ted Cruz is a senator. I mean, Madison Cawthorn is a member of Congress. Make it make sense. That's not merit. Let's talk about this because we're, at this time when sort of the demand among these right-wing groups that are stoking these parents up is to say, you must say that all white people through history were nice. They were innocent. One of my producers used this brilliant term and said, it's about innocence. Yes, they had slaves, but they were innocent. They had slaves because they just wanted them to be Christian. Of course, they fed them. They didn't want them to be sick. They wanted them to be able to work. They treated them so good. They were like a member of the family. So yes, there was slavery, but it was nice. We're nice. Thomas Jefferson, he was nice. He loved them, the children he created. Like, they needed to be nice. And yet, we're living at a time when the way that they're trying to demand this niceness is screaming at school board members to the point where they're quitting. People are threatening school boards. And now we have today, on the first day of Black History Month, at least six historically black colleges and universities have received bomb threats. So which is it? Do you want us to say that everything about white America is nice, or do you want to blow up black colleges or at least threaten to do so?
Yeah, I mean, you're making a powerful point there, very poignantly. And here's the truth. The fact is that there's nothing more dangerous or destructive or fear inducing in America than a black person with a brain, a black person who's articulate, a black person who can tell the truth. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, not by nice people. Malcolm X murdered, Medgar Evers murdered, but not by nice people. So the point is, if they were nice in murdering them, that shows you your niceness ain't enough. Innocence, as James Baldwin talked about it, and the comfort of white people. And dare we evoke Robin DiAngelo's name? Y'all proving the point. Y'all mad at Robin DiAngelo, and yet you're
she's
so
white.
Fragile. You're fragile. And she says you're fragile. Your egos are fragile, and yet you're proving the fact, oh, no, it will make us uncomfortable if you tell us the truth. Discomfort is the premise of true education. Challenging people set ways, black, white, brown, red, yellow, whatever color or race or nationality. So this is, again, an attempt to defend and to protect white people from knowledge. They don't want to be trammeled by enlightenment, so they'd rather be bulldozing knowledge away from themselves to keep the purity and innocence and comfort right there.
You know, we're at a time now where we just have this bombshell news today that the NFL is now being sued by one of its very rare black coaches. I mean, think about a league where 70% of the bodies on the field are black, but only like two or three people have ever been allowed to be coaches. They're getting now sued for racial discrimination. If you could just touch on that, but also just tell us, as a professor who has taught at universities that are predominantly white, have any of your students ever said, I'm too afraid to read this book? I can't read this book because it makes me too sad. I'm afraid of this knowledge that you're giving me and run out of your class screaming and crying? Because I think the kids are less weak than these parents are saying they are.
Yeah, they've said that, but not because of race. They just said, man, you just crazy. No, but the point, of course, that is ludicrous. They want more. My white students are going, I didn't know this. Let me learn more. Asian, black, you know, native people. And just they want more knowledge. They are really tired of the pablum that they've been fed, the infantile reductionistic knowledge that is nothing to them. They came to college to be challenged, to be uncomfortable, to understand that their ways have not been productive. And what can I learn? What can I more can I absorb in order to do this? And Brian Flores, God bless him. He's Colin Kaepernick on the coaching level. He may not ever get another coaching job again, but he has pulled the cover from off of the hypocrisy and the chicanery. And hopefully some things will change.
You know, and I've had the pleasure of, you know, teaching at both at Syracuse and at Howard University. And my white students and my black students were equally thirsty for knowledge. And I have to tell you, I taught three semesters at Syracuse. And these were almost all white students. And at the end, I got so many notes from them saying, we never get to talk about race in my life. And I really enjoyed being able to have these frank conversations where they felt safe to be able to have these open conversations. They wanted to have the conversations. Young people are not stupid. They understand that there's more to it than, you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. They know that's BS. And they want to know the real story. It's almost a crime against these young people to tell them, you're too soft to read Toni Morrison. That's absurd. I read Toni Morrison when I was in the seventh grade.
If you can't read Michelle Obama, dude, ain't nothing you can read. Michelle Obama is Americana. Michelle Obama is talking about the arc and trajectory of rising from the humble beginnings in the South Side of Chicago to become first lady of this country and to become a best-selling author. This is Horatio Alger in brown skin. What more do you want? She has translated your liturgy, your literature, and your livelihoods into a powerful literary story. Amen to her. And black folk, keep writing. The pen is mightier than the story.
Amen. And stop treating these young people like they're soft and stupid. They really can. First of all, they got the internet. You trying to ban books for them, they're going to look up all those books and buy them. They're going to read them anyway. They're smarter than you all. Stop it. Michael Eric Dyson, always appreciate you, man. Happy Black History Month. We still get to say that. That's the end of tonight's readout.
Hey, it's Mel Robbins. Let's cut to the chase. There is a change you want to make right now, but you're waiting to feel motivated. You don't need motivation. You've got me. You can change your life anytime you want. And when you're ready, the Mel Robbins podcast is here to help you with inspiration and simple science-backed tools to help you create a better life. Listen to me and you'll feel motivated, all right. Listen and follow the Mel Robbins podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.